Ready to pop the question? The jewelers at BlueNile.com have got sparkle down to a science with beautiful lab-grown diamonds worthy of your most brilliant moments. Their lab-grown diamonds are independently graded and guaranteed identical to natural diamonds, and they're ready to ship to your door. Go to BlueNile.com and use promo code LISTEN to get $50 off your purchase of $500 or more. That's code LISTEN at BlueNile.com for $50 off. BlueNile.com, code LISTEN.
Happy Friday and a good day for our mailbag segment, one of the most popular of the week. Got some great questions on the Bucks, the Rays, the Lightning, and more. And we have one in particular we're going to talk about, and we don't have to do this off the top because it's going to take a little thought before I get into it. We're going to talk about the Mount Rushmore of bad actors from Tampa Bay. We've talked about the Mount Rushmore, whether it's Evan Longoria, right, or in hockey, Steven Stamkos.
Derek Brooks, Warren Sapp,
sure, the Hall of Famers, Leroy Selman, right? Who would be on the sports Mount Rushmore in Tampa Bay? Well, who would the opposite be? The anti Mount Rushmore, the guys that you never want to see or hear about again. So we'll get into that in a little bit, but we have some other questions, so let's get started.
All right, Les had tweeted us. He says, was not drafting a wide receiver in the early rounds a mistake, considering right now the only proven receiver we have on the roster is Mike Evans? I know Chris Godwin's there, but his knee is just a concern. Seems like Todd Bowles wanted to flex his defensive muscles with the Hall pick.
Well, it's a great question, and we won't know the answer to that until they play the season, because I don't know anything really about Logan Hall in terms of what kind of NFL player he's going to be this year. He just turned 22 years old, and he really only had one great season, if you want to call it that, at the University of Houston. He's sort of a late bloomer, but again, he has a huge upside. What they did do, however, was they passed on what they said were four or five other players they would have taken at number 27. And one of those was a wide receiver, Christian Watson, from Plant High School that went to the Green Bay Packers. Now, Aaron Rodgers hasn't had great success with, you know, rookie receivers in their rookie years in Green Bay, but Watson is a special dude, you know, and if he turns out to be, you know, one of those great Packer receivers, we may look back at this and go, wow, you know, they had a guy from their own hometown that they were willing to pass on along with other players and, you know, just to move down and pick up an extra second round pick that he used on an offensive lineman. So I thought for sure, and I don't know with the first pick, but I thought for sure they were going to take a receiver. And they've signed, you know, about three or four of them in you know, for the undrafted free agents types that I think they like. But you have to also remember they went and got Russell Gage in the offseason to sort of offset, I believe, if Chris Godwin's not ready at the start of the year. Russell Gage is coming off his best season. You know, there was a lot of injuries, and Julio Jones was gone in Atlanta last year. His last eight games, he caught 50 balls, and that's a lot of catches. He's a great route runner. He can play outside. He can play the slot. So I don't know. It's a total mistake. I mean, you still have Breshad Perriman. You still have Cyril Grayson. You still have Tyler Johnson and Scotty Miller. So there are guys that have to step up and play well and play big, but I don't know that it was a mistake or not, because I got to see how these other guys they passed on, namely Christian Watson, end up doing. Was it their biggest need? Was receiver their biggest need? No, I don't think it was. And teams typically, you know, they'll tell you they're going to take the best player available, but that always means they're going to take the best player available at their biggest need. And their biggest need was interior defensive line. They had not re-signed, you know, Ndamukong Suh, and I think for that reason they felt, whether it was Devontae Wyatt, whether it was Logan Hall, they were going to get a guy that was going to come in here and play and put him next to Vita Vea and expect him to play and maybe start for them, and that's what they did. So, again, you know, the thing about the draft is they're hard to evaluate in the moment. You got to play out the season. I just know this. Last year they got one guy that played, Jotron Shawinka. He wasn't supposed to play as much as he did because there was an injury to JPP. Tell me what the rest of the class did, because I can't remember. You know, KJ Britt, sure, Grant Stewart, those guys did well on special teams. You know who didn't? Jalen Darden. And so I don't think they got much out of last year's class. So, you know, they need guys like Logan Hall to play really, really well and play right away. They got a punter. He's probably going to take the job and play right away. So they got several players. If they don't have enough receivers on this roster right now, then that's on them. But I think they addressed it in the offseason with Russell Gage. I think they're confident that Godwin's going to be back sooner than later. They won't know, you know, if he's going to be the same guy in year one or not after surgery. Mike Evans is Mike Evans. You know, he just keeps pumping out 1,000-yard seasons. And the other guys are going to have competition to try to play and make this team. You know, this is not going to be an easy roster to make at wide receiver. So that's going to elevate them as well. So a mistake, I think it depends on what Watson becomes, because he was the guy you could have taken. And also how well Hall plays. It's a little too early to say it's a mistake. I do not have a problem with them not taking a wide receiver with their first pick. But moving down was a gamble. And they moved down and picked up an offensive guard, which, you know, they've been telling us that they really liked Aaron Stinney and they really liked Robert Hainsey. So, you know, did they need the offensive guard right there? Like, that might have been more of a place to maybe address the receiver position too. So we'll see. But on the surface, I don't have a problem with what they did with their first pick.
All right, John tweeted us. He said, last week you alluded to Byron Leftwich and Tom Brady having different ideas about how to run the offense now that Bruce Arians has moved on. Do you see less emphasis on the no risk it and more of a Patriots Josh McDaniels kind of approach, striving for a 50-50 run-pass ratio?
Well, you always strive for that. But, yeah, to answer your question, I do think that this is going to look even more like a Tom Brady offense than it did last year. And it began sort of to morph into that the second half of the Super Bowl year, you know, when they had the sort of, you know, detente, if you will, between Bruce Arians and Tom Brady. And, again, you know, Byron Leftwich has done it all. I know, you know, Byron gets annoyed. You know, the perception is that this is Bruce's offense and, therefore, you know, Bruce is in control. It's really been Byron doing the game planning with Tom. Tom's going to get his way. And he does not, at age 45, want to be in a position of taking seven-step drops and, you know, seeing five guys run verticals. And there he sits, a target. He does not want that. Nor have we seen a lot of that in, you know, sort of late in the season. Doesn't mean he won't take his shots when they're there, but he wants a running game. And he wants play action. He wants a receiver out of the backfield and this sort of thing. And I do think that, you know, not that Bruce game planned because he didn't, but Todd Bowles' philosophy is a lot closer to Tom Brady's than it is to Bruce Arians in terms of offense. Like, he's a defensive coach. He wants to protect his defense. He wants to complement them. You know, he doesn't want to expose them in certain instances. You know, when you're pushing the ball downfield, you can have turnovers. You can have a lot of three and outs. We've seen this team, especially against the New Orleans Saints, have a ton of three and outs and not use any clock at all. And that can be a problem when you wear out your defense early in games like that. So I think you're going to see a more complementary approach. I think you're going to see maybe the return of some of the smaller slot receivers in addition to Godwin and guys like that. And I think it's going to be what Tom Brady wants it to be, finally. You know, whatever that is. And then again, I'm not saying, look, they won a Super Bowl together, and I don't think that Tom Brady ordered the code red, and I don't think there was an ultimatum and all those things you read about. But I do believe that Brady has things that he wants to do more of, which is run the football, and probably less of, which is, you know, seven-step drops and a lot of verticals and things like that. So to me, this is going to be the closest thing to a Brady offense we've seen in his third season, you know, to date. And that's, you know, and Byron Leftwich will be fine with it, because Byron's going to do, and he was quarterback himself, Byron's going to do whatever makes Tom the most comfortable. And who is Byron Leftwich to tell the greatest quarterback of all time, who's won seven Super Bowls, that this isn't the best way to win? And so I do expect changes for sure.
All right, Thad had tweeted us. He said, could Hall of Fame induction have some impact on Rob Gronkowski's decision? Obviously, it's not the most important factor, but assuming he's healthy and still kind of wants to play, would he rather go in alongside his buddy Tommy, or maybe go in a year earlier and get some more spotlight?
I mean, it's a great question. You're right. I don't think you make it based on that. I think that, well, here's what I think as Peter King would say. I believe that Rob Gronkowski was prepared to retire and retire fairly soon, right up until the day Tom Brady said he wasn't. And, you know, Tom was out some 41 days or so. I think if another week had gone by, you'd have seen Gronkowski pull the plug. That's what I was hearing, that he was going to go out. And now, how much of that was because, you know, he just wanted to play with Brady and no one else, or he wanted to go in the Hall of Fame with him because they're both obviously first ballot guys? I think it'd be cool, right? They spent, at least Gronk spent his whole career with Tom, and, you know, that combination, that would make sense, and I think he would really enjoy that. But I don't think it's exclusive. Like, I don't think, like, you know, you base a 17-game season and all that goes into preparing for that and all the pain that he's experienced in his career to subject himself to more, whether it's broken ribs or whatever else might come to pass. I don't think you do that just so you can stand on a stage in Canton, Ohio one day. They're both going to get in there. You know, Rob had retired. I always say this, like, you know, Gronkowski left Brady. Like, he left the game. And Brady was going to continue to play, and he knew that. And so he was fine if his Hall of Fame clock started ahead of Tom's before. Why wouldn't he be fine with it now? So it's a neat little thing to think about. I don't think he spends an inordinate amount of time thinking about it. And I believe that, you know, I think that decision is going to be based very little on, you know, on what happens in Canton in 5 years. I think it's going to be based largely on how he feels. And I don't know that he's totally decided yet. My guess is he'll play. I know he's only going to play here. I know that he detests anything in the off season with respect to OTAs, even the mandatory minicamp. He can blow off and just wait and sign until right before training camp if that's what he wants to do. But I do think there's a part of him that's really looking to see, you know, what am I missing here? What am I passing up? And he's retired once. Retiring the second time wouldn't be that difficult for him. There's got to be a reason why he hasn't decided one way or the other, right? He could be torn, or he could be like, you know what, I am going to play. And I think this is more likely. I am going to play. I know I'm going to play. But if I announce that I'm playing now, they're going to want to see me, you know, June 7th through 9th at the mandatory minicamp. I'm not about that. I'm not going to do that. I'll show up in July. I'll let them know then, you know. And there's some cap situations as well that maybe the team would like to clean up and address. So there's a lot of factors, but I do think that, you know, he's going to take as much time as he feels he needs. And I it's interesting. I said this on Twitter the other day. It's like, people just think like, well, you know, why wouldn't he play? Well, you know, you're not the one that's had the 18 surgeries, and you're not the one that cracked four ribs last year and punctured your lung. And I think people don't understand what the off season is like to prepare. You know, like, if you let yourself get out of shape, you're never going to play. Now, Gronk always works out, and you know, they've shown him working out with various guys this off season, but like, the sacrifice they make physically to play this game, and not just the off season, but the pain they go through during the year, the length of the season. If you get in the playoffs, you're talking about 20, 21 weeks now. I mean, that is, you know, such a marathon. It's like, hey, man, you've run 10 Boston marathons. Do you want to sign up for one right now? And it's like, I literally just got done running the marathon. Don't talk to me about a marathon. I'm completely exhausted. I don't want to think about it. I my feet hurt. I've lost weight. I got hamstring injuries. Like, it's kind of that way. You know, it's kind of like asking a guy, hey, are you down for the pain? Are you down for the grind? And not just any grind, 17 regular season games plus what you hope is a Super Bowl run. So it's just not, and you know, and you've got all the money in the world too, by the way. This is the other thing. Like, the money has gotten so big. There's a reason Ali Marpet quit at age 27, 28 years old. It's because he could, right? He's made $30, $40 million in his career. He feels great. A lot of information on what this game does to you later in life, whether it's CTE or other things. And, you know, here's Gronkowski with a supermodel girlfriend, SI swimsuit model, like, tremendous family. He's smart as hell. I know he plays the Gronk thing pretty well, but, like, he really is an astute businessman from that standpoint. And, like, you know, sometimes when you figure out what you want to do with the rest of your life, you want it to start as soon as possible. And so that could be what he's thinking. You know, what if he wants to get married and have a family? Like, there's so many things that we don't consider when we're just fans of football teams or football players. You just feel like, well, why wouldn't he play? Well, you know, because this is his life. And I really do think that he's thinking hard about it. At the end of the day, if I'm a betting man, I bet that he does play, and I bet that he plays here. But I also bet that you won't hear that decision until after June 7 through 9 when that mandatory minicamp is over. Probably not till July, in fact.
All right, Rick had tweeted us. He said, Rick, which game would be the best opening game matchup for the Bucks? Would love another opening day matchup with them Cowboys so we could start out 1-0 again.
Yeah, well, that 1-0 was pretty shaky, wasn't it? I mean, that game came down to the wire. They needed a last-second drive to win that one. Cowboys were really good that night. That was a hell of a game. It was a hell of a way to open the season, for sure. I think, I mean, if you're going with, like, games you can win, right? Like, just games you think you have a shot at winning. I don't know. You know, Carolina's probably the most unsettled team in the NFC South if they were going to start with a division opponent. I don't think you want to go to San Francisco. I don't think you want to go to Arizona. I don't think you want to play the Chiefs or the Bengals right away. It's maybe an opponent you're familiar with, like Carolina, if you're just, you know, wanting to jump into the division and, you know, at home, maybe get a W or something like that. But the rest of them, like I said, man, there are no easy games this year.
Maybe you start at Pittsburgh. It's a marquee team matchup, but yeah, their quarterback's unsettled. And
yeah, that could be a good one. That could be a good one. Although playing up there is tough.
It is.
You know?
But, you know, it's a little cooler up there, too, at that, you know, early September or mid-September.
Yeah, it would be nice. Yeah, it would be nicer up there. Yeah, that's a good one. That's a good one because you don't know, you know, who they're going to have. Is it going to be Mitch Trubisky? Is it going to be the, you know, the rookie that they just drafted from Pitt? I mean, if it's the rookie, then it's his first bite of the apple everywhere, right? It's hard to win in the NFL. Really hard to win your first game against Tom Brady in the NFL, right? That would be a big mountain. So that's a good one. I like that.
What about at Cleveland? Especially if Deshaun Watson is suspended, then that would be a much easier game in theory.
Yeah, in theory it would be.
Although we don't know if that'll happen. But
I don't know what's going to happen with that. I'd rather go to Cleveland. I'll say this. I'd rather go to Cleveland in September than in December.
Mm-hmm.
I'll tell you that much. So from that
same
standpoint.
With Pittsburgh.
same with the Steelers. So, yeah, let's give them a northern team on the road that they could play in September where the weather's nice.
That works. Yeah. Well, we'll find out the schedule Thursday night, correct?
That's
Thursday, right. 8 p.m.?
May 12th, yep.
So let's see how it lines up.
The schedule will go.
Yep.
Win. Yeah, exactly. The Gruden thing, right?
Yep. We're going to win them all.
Man, win, 17-0, man. That's how it goes.
All right, we'll switch to baseball here unless it tweeted. Rick, my mailbag from a few weeks ago asked if you were concerned about Mike Zunino. Well, he's now 5-47 with 19 Ks. At what point will you get worried? Now, he sent this question in before Zunino hit the home run on Tuesday night.
You know what? I never was a big Mike Zunino guy. Okay, the best he's going to do is bat 200. Well, the only thing you want from him are home runs and good defense, and so his average is sort of inconsequential. I think you figure he's going to make 3 out of 4 outs at, you know, and maybe more than that, 2 out of 10, you know, 8 out of 10 outs every time he's up. But if he could run into a few, that's what he's in there for. When he stops hitting home runs, and he hasn't hit many yet, that's when it's like, okay, why is this guy playing? He still does a good job with the pitchers. It's a difficult pitching staff to handle. I don't know that Mejia – in fact, I know Mejia is not the catcher that Zunino is, not even close. And so, you know, I think defensively, when you look at how this team is built, the way their pitching has carried them to this point, I think it's important to have Zunino behind the plate. But I'm not – like, I was never been concerned. If you're a Rays fan, are you ever concerned about the catchers hitting in this town? I mean, when was – you know,
Jose Molina.
Rare. Yeah, right, exactly. I mean, they have a – it's a long litany of guys that couldn't hit, you know, that caught. So I'm not – that's not where I'm looking for my offense. I thought last year Zunino was an all-star, deserved it, had his best year, hit a ton of bombs. That's the prototypical year you want from Mike Zunino. If Mike Zunino comes close to that every season, man. He's more than earned his money. Now, the problem is that you have to make contact in order to hit home runs, and he was just awful to begin the season. Now, there's been talk about a shoulder injury. I don't know how that feels. He said, I was reading after the game, he said that he's starting to feel, his swing come back a little bit. He yoked a slider that just kind of spun up there, which is a good sign. It wasn't just a fastball that he jumped on. So, you got to trust guys when they say they're starting to. And also, and you've talked about this, Steve, is like that no spring training is a factor for these guys.
And he hurt his shoulder in spring training. So, we know that he was hurt. How healthy is he now? We don't know.
Right. But the at-bats, you need to see. It's different, man. You could sit over there and take as much batting practice as you want to. But, man, you get out there with the wicked stuff these guys throw in a game situation. You need at-bats to get settled, to just relax. And it sucks when you get off to a good start or a bad start because you may have to play 2 months to get your average back to 200, right, once you have enough 1-for-32s. But I just think that all that kind of conspired against him. The injury, the short spring training, you're not a good hitter to begin with. So let's see. Let's see if he heats up now after what was an enormous blast for him the other day. What a comeback by the Rays in that game. They were down, 5-1, I think? 5-0?
After they gave the grand slam in the first inning, Yarbrough did.
Yeah, and they pecked away at it, and their pitching was great again out of the bullpen, which has been really the star of the early Rays season. So, yeah, Zunino and my concern, I go back to disappointed. Discouraged, I'll go the Lovie Smith route. I'll go back to disappointed, but not discouraged.
I'm Sandra, and I'm just the professional your small business was looking for. But you didn't hire me, because you didn't use LinkedIn Jobs. LinkedIn has professionals you can't find anywhere else, including those who aren't actively looking for a new job, but might be open to the perfect role, like me.
In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't visit other leading job sites. So if you're not looking on LinkedIn, you'll miss out on great candidates, like Sandra. Start hiring professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
All right, we'll end on this one. And Kevin had tweeted us this last week, and we held it over because we thought it was such a good topic, we wanted to give a little more time to it. He says, continuing down misery lane, because it's an interesting conversation, who is on your anti-Mount Rushmore for Tampa Bay sports? Antonio Brown comes to mind. I'm sure most will say Stu Sternberg.
All right, I'm going to sound biased if I jump on the Antonio Brown bandwagon because I'm the guy that came up with the whole news about the fake vaccination cards, and then he came back and he lost his mind, and then he ripped off his shirt and BA fired him at the end of the game. So is Antonio Brown one of the bigger villains? He's not a bust, right? I mean, remember what Antonio Brown did. He came in here 8 games into the first season with Tom Brady.
Helped him win a Super Bowl.
They won a Super Bowl in large part because of Antonio Brown. And if you look at the Super Bowl itself, I mean, the guy, caught a touchdown pass, and he had a touchdown catch against Washington in the playoff game. He was really, really good. So from a performance standpoint, yeah, his second year was sort of a train wreck, if you will, especially the personal meltdown and all that we remember. But yeah, a villain perhaps, but don't diminish what he did. He helped bring you a Lombardi trophy. That's undeniable. So it depends on how you feel about him, right? Do you take the image of him, ripping off his shirt and getting fired after the Jets game, or, do you remember him in the Super Bowl with the tutty, But I get that he wasn't the most furry guy, that the Bucs have ever had. We talked about, and we should probably, have this discussion. How do you feel about the owners of some of these franchises in Tampa Bay? And I would just say, some of them are founding owners. I'll start with Hugh Culverhouse. Hugh Culverhouse was reviled in this town because, starting off with the fact, the Bucks didn't have any success at all. They were 0-26. I mean, they were, the late night jokes on Johnny Carson and all of that, right? He hires a college coach in John McKay, who comes from USC, but in the third season, after starting 0-26 and 76-77, third season in 79, they're in the NFC Championship game. No, they host the NFC Championship game. They upset the Philadelphia Eagles, host the NFC Championship game, lose 9-0 in a game that Doug Williams got hurt, or they could have. They were one game from the Super Bowl. And so you're like, wow, that's amazing. Like, how quick they had success. And believe me, folks, back in those days, you didn't get good players off other teams if you're an expansion team. You got the dregs of other teams. You got the worst players. They could protect all their good players. So it wasn't like the rules are today. And then you thought, well, so what went sideways after that? The whole Doug Williams fiasco over money. You know, you lose Doug Williams, who was the absolute leader of that football team. They offered him $600,000 in a part of Tampa Sphere, which just was some real estate development that, you know, the Hugh Culver House had claimed. And after that, you know, just his unwillingness to spend any money, especially when we got towards the era of free agency. Remember, this guy sat on the management council. He absolutely ushered in the or exited, got, you know, led to the exit of the USFL. He was a lead owner banging that drum. And he just wouldn't spend money. And his choices of coaches weren't good, right, until the Culver House Trust took over with Rich McKay and Stephen Story and Jack Donlin and those guys. They hired, I think, not only the Sam Weich was here, but then they hired, you know, Tony Dungy. And so that was a great development at that point. But never put any money back into the product. Didn't make any excuses for, you know, what he thought was winning, which was at the box office, you know, in terms of TV money and things like that. And so I don't think he's a very liked owner. Now, but then you go from him, and what about Vince Namoli? You know, like Vince Namoli got a lot of the same sort of grief, right? And yet he was a founding owner of that franchise. There is no Tampa Bay Rays without Vince Namoli.
The way, and I wasn't here during this time, but the way Vince Namoli was described to me, he was the perfect owner to get a team here.
Yeah.
Because not many could have got that done.
Correct.
But he was the worst owner to run the team.
Mm-hmm.
That without Vince Namoli, there is no team here.
Right.
Any other ownership group would have not have been able to do what he did and work it the way he did.
Right.
But then when it came to running the franchise, it left a lot to be desired.
It did. And it wasn't until they were rebranded under Stuart Sternberg and those guys that they really got mm-hmm. going again. And even Sternberg could have and may have put himself in that position. I think Sternberg has proven he's one of the better owners in baseball from the standpoint of the way he's structured his organization, whom he's hired, how they've thought out of the box to compete with big market teams, some of the trends that those guys that he's hired have set in baseball. However, you were going to move the team to Montreal for at least half the season and maybe more, depending on what would have gone on. Major League Baseball shut it down. So we'd have a different opinion if this team was pulling out of here to go to Montreal of Stuart Sternberg. The Lightning have had a bunch of sort of sketchy owners, right? Mm-hmm. I mean, Orrin Kulas was one, or Orrin Clueless, as I used to call him back in the day. How about Art Williams, the old insurance agent that owned the hockey team for a while?
Yeah, don't ask Phil Esposito about him.
I just remember the press conference, man. Have you ever heard the press conference? You mm-hmm. should Google that one. Woo! He was a cowboy, man. He goes, are you a stud or a dud? I want studs. it was like, because he's a football guy, you know, mm-hmm. and he brought that mentality to the hockey club, and everybody's like, who is this dude with your mostly Canadian hockey team? So there's been some of those. Let's see, who else?
Even the Glazers. So,
yeah,
I mean,
to some degree.
We went down Misery Lane a couple weeks ago. For 3 years, they refused to spend money on the team.
Absolutely did.
When they didn't have a floor, and they could do that and not sign
anybody. Watched it happen. Yeah.
A lot of bad coaching hires. I mean, you can go through the list of Schiano.
5 and 10 years. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
But they've brought two Lombardi trophies to Tampa Bay.
And you can't excuse them for those 3 seasons, and I don't think anybody should, that they were dabbling mm-hmm. in Man U and trying to take advantage of the system, you know, mm-hmm. where there was no minimum salaries for players. I mean, they absolutely gutted the team so that they could have the lowest payroll to maximize their profits. You can't excuse them for that. But on top of everything else, like after that, okay, from that point forward, mm-hmm. I really think they've done everything. I do. The one thing I'll say about the Glazers is I do think they want to win. And I do think they're willing to do what it takes to win. They built a big facility for the practice. It took them 12 years, but they did it, right? Mm-hmm. They have state-of-the-art stuff. They've hired coaches, good and bad, but out-of-the-box hires, trying to shake something up and win a Super Bowl. You know, trading for John Gruden was a bold move, brought him a Super Bowl. Firing Tony Dungy was a risky thing to do. You know, a beloved coach that took him to the playoffs 4 out of 6 years and had him on the brink at an NFC championship game in 99. You fired that guy, but you know what? You traded a ton for John Gruden, which probably hurt you in later years, but you got the Lombardi Trophy. You know, same thing, like the bold move to have a team good enough to get Tom Brady to buy into your organization, to him take a look at this and say, yeah, I want to come there. You know, hiring Bruce Arians. And they went through a lot of coaches. I mean, I'm not going to, you know, they tried to hire guys that didn't come out of the box, you know, whether it was Steve Spurrier, going back to Jimmy Johnson, they ended up with Dungy. That was Culverhouse Trust. And then the Glazers come in and they get John Gruden. And then, you know, they make some bad moves too because Greg Schiano was no way and no how a good hire. But they kept trying. They had 5 coaches in 10 years. And they kept trying to find, you know, the right guy. And I always felt like they wanted to win. I just felt like they didn't know who to trust to get it done, you know. So,
But you also talked about Sue Sternberg. The Glazers were close to moving this team to Baltimore.
They were. Oh, they were there. Listen, I'll never forget the call from Rich McKay the night that, of all things, right, the Cleveland Browns took that deal. The Cleveland Browns pulled out of Cleveland to go to Baltimore. And who would have thought that would have ever happened? And when it did, it completely took away the leverage that the Glazers had. They were devastated by that news. They never thought that would occur. And, of course, the NFL put a team back in Cleveland, and now the Ravens are the former Cleveland Browns are now the Ravens. But that absolutely gutted them. They managed to get a stadium through a half-cent sales tax referendum in Hillsborough County that also included firemen and teachers and police and stuff like that. So, you know, I think Rich McKay had a lot to do with sort of navigating the political landscape there, and they were grateful to him. And so they made it work, but they would have pulled this team out. Absolutely. They were not, you know, they wanted to make it work here, but they knew it wouldn't work here without a stadium. And if they hadn't gotten a stadium, much like Stuart Sternberg, they were looking for alternatives and thought they had one, you know, in Baltimore. There's other guys. Like, I think of players, like, and I don't know that they were necessarily really disliked at the time, but one of the most unlikable guys I've seen, how about Aubrey Huff? You know, for all the hype about him. Now, there's been other guys, like, you know, that came in here, made money, didn't do anything. You know, Vinny Castilla, which they used to call him Castiller, you know, stuff like that. He's a decent guy, pretty good player back in his day. Alvin Harper. If you're just looking for busts, if we were going to go down the bust lane, you got a long list of them in Tampa Bay. But Harper was one of those guys.
How about coach, Barry Melrose?
Yes. 16 games, right? Is that what he lasted? 16
something
games?
Like that, yeah.
Yeah. Yeah. And, you just can't come in here and do that, you know. And Melrose, because of that, I don't know that Melrose has always given them a great shake on TV either, like when I've seen him back in the day, but – that was a tragic situation. It's interesting. I mean, you know, Tampa Bay is obviously we're Tampa Bay now, but we're full of misery too, right? Like you talk about misery lane. I mean, they even Greg Schiano. I mean, you know, that ended. We had MRSA. We had inactive suites. We had the Josh Freeman disaster. You know, just. Not necessarily ready for the NFL like you needed him to be.
What about over at USF? I mean, you know, Jim Leavitt built the program, had it successful, was fired.
Was the number two team in the country, let's be honest. Yeah. I mean, he got them as high as number two in the nation. It wasn't a fluke. You know, they beat a really good West Virginia team. I'll never forget that, at Raymond James, and actually went to Rutgers and lost to Greg Schiano. And Ray Rice, I believe, and that was, you know, sort of the highest. That was sort of still to this day, you know. I mean, they were, look, you couldn't get a ticket to that game at Raymond James. against West Virginia. That's how hot they were. That's how good they were. Mm-hmm. And I'm personally invested in Jimmy Leavitt because I've known him since he was 17 years old. And, you know, my dad coached him, full disclosure, in baseball. He was all Big 8 instead of Big 12. Now it's Big 12. All Big 8 at Missouri in both baseball and football. Like, that stuff doesn't happen today, right? You're talking Bo Jackson type stuff. And that's who Jimmy Leavitt was. He worked it out of a trailer. You know, they worked out of a trailer over there at USF. And it meant something to him because he's from St. Petersburg, Dixie Hollins High School, my high school, all of that. And, you know, what he brought USF to in a short time was unbelievable. And it has not gotten back there since. The closest it came was probably under Willie Taggart when Quentin Flowers showed up. And that saved Taggart's job. I know how it ended for Jimmy. I know about why they dismissed him putting his hands on a player, that sort of thing. I have some questions about that personally, you know, some of the stories I've heard. But regardless, I don't think he's a villain, you know. Mm-hmm. Might see him that way.
Well, I was saying more that, you know, I mean, Skip Holtz was okay. Charlie Strong did not do good here.
Charlie Strong did not do well. No.
You know, Willie Taggart was about ready to be gone when Quentin Flowers went off.
Yep.
I mean, you know, you guys were on the radio ready to fire him.
I had to ask him, yeah. But I never forget. He was calling every Tuesday. It was like his second year, I think, second or third season. And I looked at Tom and I said, we have to ask him if he's worried about his job. And we did. And he said, well, you know, he gave the standard football answer, which was, I just got to, you know, worried about this weekend. I can't, you know, I just got to focus on now. We're gonna play a new quarterback. We're going to play Quentin Flowers. He's going to start for us. The rest is history. Literally, they were, I want to say my memory is not that great, but I want to say they were 2-4 mm-hmm. when that change occurred or something like that. And obviously we know that Flowers, you know, took it to the next level. So, yeah, there's been a lot of characters in Tampa Bay. I mean, you're talking about, you know, how about Kellen Winslow Jr.?
Ooh.
You know? How about that? And we know what a bad guy he is now, right? Mm-hmm. It wasn't much better then, trust me. You know, we've covered some characters, you know, on these
we didn't even
teams.
Mention Jameis Winston, who could be.
Jameis Winston is probably, you know, he was the most polarizing player in Bucs history, I think. You know, I half the people loved him, and that's not too strong a term. They still loved Jameis Winston. The other half didn't want him here at all. Mm-hmm. And I think that hurt him. I think, I think he battled that. You know, he wanted so much to be accepted, and he was put to his defense. And I know, you know, people think I'm not a Jameis guy. I'm not an anybody guy. I'm not a Brady guy. I don't care. But at the end of the day, like, Jameis Winston is a people pleaser. He wants to please everybody, and that's to a fault, by the way, mostly his family. But the thing about it is, you know, nobody worked harder, all that stuff. He simply didn't play well, but he went to a horrible, horrible football team. Mm-hmm. You know, when you're the first overall pick in the draft, the team you go to, they're at 32 for a reason, man. They're not good at all. And he underwent some coaching changes. Now, he did have continuity with Dirk Cutter in the offense because Cutter later became his head coach. But a lot that went on back in the early days was not his fault. He was put in an impossible situation. It's hard to lead guys, older players, men that have families and stuff, when, you know, you've never played in the NFL. Like, you're trying to learn your job. You're trying to, you know, be successful. And, you know, you have to also kind of, like, be the leader of the football team. Like, you usually have to earn that first. Even at the quarterback position, which is a position of leadership by its definition. But, like, you know, he had to walk that line between, hey, I haven't done anything in this league, and, oh, yeah, by the way, follow me. You know what I mean? Like, it was hard for him. And who was following him, really? And what kind of talent was around him? So, you know, towards the end, they had talented guys. And he still, you know, he didn't win. And ultimately, that's why he was bounced out of here. But, yeah, Jameis had a lot of detractors, man, you know, and he also had a lot of people, like I said, that loved him unconditionally. It was a unique experience with him. Hey, thanks for your questions. We went a little long on that one, but you can send us more anytime. You can do that on Twitter at SportsDayTB. Reach me on Twitter at NFL Stroud, or my email address is rstroud@tampabay.com. Game 3 tonight at Amalie Arena. Of course, it's the Leafs and the Lightning, and then Game 4 is on Sunday. The Rays continue their series in Seattle. We'll talk about all of it on Monday. For Steve Burstick, I'm Rick Stroud of the Tampa Bay Times. Have a great weekend, everybody.
Tired of ads interfering with your favorite sports podcasts? Good news. Ad-free listening is available on Amazon Music for all the music plus top podcasts included with your Prime membership. Stay ahead of the game by downloading the Amazon Music app for free or go to amazon.com/sportsadfree. That's amazon.com/sportsadfree to catch up on the latest episodes without the ads.